Hello, welcome to this week's podcast. I'm NPR science editor Alison Richards.
And I'm science desk producer Giselle Grayson.
It was a big week for archaeology. There were tombs uncovered in Britain that probably contain the remains of Roman gladiators.
And oyster remains in Jamestown give us clues as to why many settlers died after the first few months of landing.
And in the world of marine life, a fish in Maine may be being overwhelmed by an invasive species. And in the Gulf, what to do with the oil they're trying to clean up. But first, those ancient skeletons excavated in York. They may be Roman gladiators. In the past few years, researchers have uncovered 80 grave sites from the 2nd and 3rd centuries, when the Romans were living in Britain. Several of the skulls had been decapitated, and one even had bite marks, possibly from a large carnivore. John Walker of York Archaeological Trust carried out the research, and he talked to NPR's Melissa Block.
Mr. Walker, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And what was it that made you first start to think that this could be a Roman cemetery full of the remains of gladiators?
We started coming along a lot of decapitated burials. In other words, there we had skeletons and somebody chopped their heads off and thrown them in the grave. They were big men for the time, very muscular. And also they have very strong, one arm was very strong, so they've been using one arm an awful lot through their life.
You said you could tell they were very muscular, and I can't quite figure out how you would know that. I'm assuming all you're working with is bones, right?
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, if you've got really big muscles, the parts where they're connected to the bone will actually grow more at those connection points. So practice will make you bigger.
So you put these pieces together, one arm stronger, muscular men, heads cut off, and you think, could be a scene of gladiators.
Could be, and then you start getting the little twists. Some of them have been hit on the head with a hammer. That is always been suspected as a thing that happens to some gladiators. So they get hit on the head first to render them unconscious. And then, of course, finally, we have this lovely bone with this lion or tiger bite. And there are no lions or tigers in England that have ever roamed free.
Now, how could you tell it was a lion or tiger bite in the bone?
Well, I'm not the particular expert, but the osteopathologist has done an awful lot of study of injuries to human bones, and it's a CSI moment. The only thing that will fit the mark on the bone is lion or tiger.
Well, what are the alternate theories of what this could be? If it weren't gladiators, what's maybe a less sexy theory of what these folks
could be? The less sexy, more humdrum theory is that they are actually prisoners. Believe it or not, it was a privilege if you're a Roman citizen to be decapitated. So could these guys all actually be military guys that have been executed for desertion or whatever? Of course, where it falls apart is on this tiger bite. Later on, we're going to conduct a real experiment. On the 14th of June, we're going to open up a website with the basic evidence on it and invite the public to vote.
I see. Everybody gets a say in this.
So everybody gets a say, which I think is a good way of introducing people to the problems of archaeology.
John Walker, thank you for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
John Walker is the chief executive of the York Archaeological Trust. We've been talking about a site in northern England that may be a Roman gladiator cemetery.
And now, across the pond from your homeland to mine, I grew up in Williamsburg, Virginia, which is about 10 minutes away from Jamestown. And in 1607, as you can never forget when you live in the area, in 1607, 104 settlers landed at Jamestown. But in less than a year, only about a third were still alive. According to UC Davis researcher Howard Spiro, one of the factors was probably the terrible drought in Virginia at the time. He thinks this because he has studied their litter, the litter in the form of oyster shells. Guy Raz talked to Spiro.
Welcome to the program.
Oh, great to be here.
So describe precisely what kind of trash these early settlers left behind, and where was it found?
The trash is basically shell heaps that were left behind when the settlers were eating oysters collected from nearby reefs around the fort.
These are oyster shells.
These are oyster shells. And the governor who arrived at the fort instructed everybody to clean up, and they dumped the empty oyster shells down the well, and this becomes our archaeological archive for reconstructing what was going on in the fort four centuries ago.
Now, it's long been known that there was a drought at Jamestown, and that's been based on the study of tree rings in the area. But you guys were able to get a better sense of the severity of that drought. How are you able to figure that out from 17th century oyster shells?
The oysters growing in the James River at the time are recording in the microchemistry of their shell a very, very precise record of temperature and salinity, or the saltiness of the river during the life of the oyster. And what we're able to do is to section the oysters from the well and very, very carefully analyze the shell calcium carbonate for isotopes of oxygen. These are very abundant. We have oxygen isotopes within our bodies, and the most common, oxygen 18 and oxygen 16, changes when the temperature of the water changes and when the salinity changes, and this is recorded within the shell. And from that, we're able to reconstruct what the temperature and what the salinity or the saltiness of the water is and infer things about rainfall upriver from the James Colony during this period of time.
And so what did you find?
Well, we found that during the life of these oysters, which we believe occurs somewhere between about 1608 and 1611, that the summer rainfall had basically shut off and the area around the Jamestown Fort was extremely salty, maybe half seawater salinity, and this became a major problem for the settlers because for the first year and a half they were drinking water out of the James River and most likely had a lot of serious medical conditions from drinking this water.
So how else would the drought have affected them? Aside from having a difficult time finding fresh water, would they have been able to grow things? Would they have been able to find animals to hunt?
Well, they definitely were able to go out and forage and hunt for animals. Their biggest problem at the time were the Algonquin Indians in the area very quickly became enemies and were firing on the early settlers continuously. So the oyster reefs around the James Fort became the primary source, most likely, of food.
It basically became their staple. They had to depend on oysters.
That's exactly right. It's something that I would love to do and for a short period of time, but it would be a tough life for a year and a half or so.
That's Howard Spiro. He's a professor of geology at the University of California, Davis. His study on the drought conditions at Jamestown can be found in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Professor Spiro, thanks.
Thanks, Guy.
Continuing on up the East Coast, there's a remote pond in the largest old-growth forest in New England that's home to one of just a few populations of blue-backed char in the United States. But in this pond, these trout-like fish have been nearly wiped out by other fish that were introduced to the pond illegally. Murray Carpenter has this story.
The best way to get to Big Reed Pond is to drive 2 hours over unpaved logging roads to Bradford Camps on Munsungan Lake, then hitch a ride in a float plane with Igor Sikorsky, who runs the sporting camp. Today he is carrying Frank Frost, a state fisheries biologist. Frost has a chest cooler, and he is hoping to use it to airlift some of the pond's rare blueback char. Big Reed Pond sits in the middle of the largest old-growth forest in New England, a 5,000-acre reserve owned by the Nature Conservancy. Sikorsky has a lease on a few acres here with two cabins.
There's no cell phone coverage here. There's no communication with the outside world. There's gas lights and an outdoor fireplace and a very comfortable outhouse and a pond that's all to yourself, really.
Sikorsky used to fly his guests over to fish for bluebacks. These fish are cousins of Arctic char that have lived in a dozen main lakes since the glaciers receded. Frost says the bluebacks face a problem that is familiar nationwide.
People moving fish from one place to another where they shouldn't be, they never have occurred, creates huge problems for us around the state.
Rainbow smelt are little bait fish native to coastal Maine. They were likely dumped in the pond by anglers hoping to fatten up the native bluebacks and brook trout. Instead, the abundant little smelt are competing with native fish for food, and even eating young bluebacks. Frost plans to use the fish poison rotenone to kill the invaders this fall. That's why Lana Perry and Jesse Kuster have been working at Big Reed for 4 weeks, trying to net any remaining bluebacks.
Hauling the net right now. This is the 200-foot net.
But in this set of the net, Perry catches only smelt. It seems most of the bluebacks have been caught after a few years of effort. That's a total of just 8 fish, now at a northern Maine hatchery. It's a lot of work, but University of Maine biology professor Michael Kinnison says each of the remaining blueback populations is distinct and valuable. And he says these fish also face threats from a warming climate.
You know, an Arctic species living this far south is going to face some pretty tough challenges.
Looking over the shore of Big Reed Pond, Frank Frost says the ecological problems caused by introduced fish can be easily avoided.
Just don't move the fish. It's as simple as that.
If all goes well, the pond will be smelt-free when the 8 airlifted bluebacks and their progeny spawned in the hatchery are flown back in next summer. For NPR News, I'm Murray Carpenter.
Finally, we turn to the ongoing spill in the Gulf of Mexico. There's a lot of oil, as we know, but also a growing mountain of waste from the cleanup efforts. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, a network of waste companies is involved in handling everything from the oil sucked out of the Gulf to clothing contaminated in the cleanup.
BP says the oil floating in the Gulf belongs to BP, and the company is trying to salvage whatever it can. Experts say that oil pumped from close to the source can be sent to refineries and turned into petroleum products, but most of the oil is too weathered to be reused. Wierd Koops, chair of the Spill Response Group Holland, says you can tell just by looking at aerial footage of the spill.
We call it chocolate mousse because the red-brown color. And the red-brown color happens when oil picks up more than 60% water.
Spill Response Group Holland has just flown in special equipment known as sweeping arms that can suck up 92,000 gallons an hour. That's much more than the skimmers that had been in use. The mix of oil and water that is gathered by skimmers then follows a long journey through the complex world of waste processing. BP's Tracy Dyer says the company sends the mix by barge to shore, where they process it before handing it off to commercial waste companies.
We dewater it as well. So we take the water phase off and send that to a commercial disposal facility that can manage that waste.
Some of the oil that is separated out might be usable as fuel for ships or to make asphalt. BP says it has sucked up about 14 million gallons of oily water. The water portion of that is considered contaminated and has to be handled with care. Much of it will end up at commercial waste collection facilities across the region, like River Birch Landfill in Avondale, Louisiana. Vic Culpepper is technical director there.
If it's water contaminated with hydrocarbons, we would send it to our Class 1 non-hazardous injection well.
River Birch constructed these injection wells to store the waste generated from the oil industry on a routine basis. The company pumps the contaminated water to a sand layer 7,000 feet below the surface.
It's a porous sand layer. It has liquids in the interstices of the pores, but it's a sand layer.
Now, if River Birch receives solid waste, say contaminated soil, that has to be handled differently. They add an agent to solidify any liquids, and it is put into a special landfill. The same goes for any other solids, according to Rodney Mallett of Louisiana's Department of Environmental Quality.
Contaminated rags, gloves, all the disposable personal protective equipment is classified as a solid waste, and it goes to the Type 1 DEQ-permitted landfill that has the double liner and the leachate collection system,
which helps keep any runoff out of the groundwater. Even though the spill is already generating huge amounts of waste, Rodney Mallett isn't worried about finding space for it all.
We have a lot of landfill space that we, believe me, when you live right here on the Gulf Coast and you have hurricanes like we have had recently, we understand landfill space as well as anyone.
The waste disposal problem is generating business for a whole host of companies, for oil recyclers, commercial landfills, and waste management folks. All of them are answerable to a network of federal, state, and local regulators who are working overtime trying to inspect all of this stuff and make sure it's being handled properly. Sam Phillips with Louisiana's Department of Environmental Quality says he's already calculating his tab.
Any hour that I spend working on this, we have a separate billing system. And we are going to bill BP for our hourly rate as well at DEQ.
So the spill will generate another kind of waste, a pile of billable receipts for BP. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
And that's it for this week's podcast. This is Giselle Grayson. Thanks for listening.
And a heads up. At the beginning of July, the Science Desk is starting a series of stories on how we got to be the humans that we are. You'll be able to listen on your radio, on the web, and right here on your podcast. Thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Alison Richards.
Now when he was a young man, he never thought he'd see people stand in line to see the boy king. How'd you get so funky? Did you do the monkey?